Thank you for this nice introduction about the privacy thing. Well, actually, it's not quite certain that I'm writing a book about it, but it is certainly an idea that maybe could grow into a book one day. And generally, yes, I'm basically always putting some crazy ideas that I like into the discourse of the areas that I walk through in my cultural environment, which mostly includes a lot of geek culture, and but also some people from other interesting areas. And so I like to write texts about stuff that I think is on the one hand somewhat new and on the other hand somewhat provoking to the people that I present it to. So the whole privacy thing I basically put out to provoke the hacker culture, in which in Germany is a very much pro data protection. And so I tried to trigger something by being totally anti-data protection. But anyway, now to my talk that I'm going to hold now, it will actually be not so very much about post-privacy, but actually, as the title suggests, it's about killing the power of time. Or to be more precise, what I mean by that is that how to kill the effects of time, in the sense of time changes things and things get lost. So if you have information and you want it to travel through time from, let's say, a point in the past to the present or to the future, and then you often have the problem that information traveling that direction will have some amount of loss, because time's agent change provides for stuff like, for example, people as they grow old forgetting, or ink with which you have written something on a piece of paper fading away. So in general, there's a problem of how to actually extend information over a large amount of time without losing it. And I think that to extend information that way often involves many processes of translating and copying between media of mind and matter. And I think if you now put the word archiving into this preservation of information effort, now I think I've all mentioned all the three words that I have to use to be allowed to talk here in this track at this conference. So about this whole information preservation thing. Now I have listened to, for example, the previous talk, and I'm a little afraid that what I'm going to say will not quite match this, the level of philosophical elaborateness. But still, I hope that I can provide some interesting examples of challenges that one might face in preserving information over the amount of time, and what this has to do with translating stuff from one medium to another, and also maybe where we are successful in that and maybe where we are not. So I'm basically talking about four different things which I have given titles to that you can see here, and some of them may be a little more clear than others, and I hope, where it is not the case that they are clear, that I will be able to explain a bit more of them. And I think I will jump straight into the first one. So preservation of self. Now, self-preservation, of course, is a common urge among life forms on our planet. Now, to us humans, now we can argue a lot about what this self means that we want to preserve, but I want to start with a somewhat not very specific and simple definition by just arguing that there is this assortment of information processes like consciousness, like memories, like what some people might call personality, mind. And this is all stuff that usually gets thrown into one bag with what we usually term ourself. And now, this thing is a kind of information process. You could put it into the mind part of the matter versus mind area that we've drawn. But the interesting thing is, of course, that to a large degree, we actually assume that we know a point where it emerges, that is our brain, and we've heard quite a lot of interesting things about it, that in the previous talk. And so the problem is there is some connection of these information processes to the matter world, to the materialistic world, And this brain thing, of course, is not just in itself that which is responsible for all this stuff happening, but actually the brain, of course, is part of our human body. And this human body is a huge machine full of extraordinary energy devices and pumps and so on that keep alive this machine in our head, which in itself then keeps alive these information processes. So if something would happen to this body and that would hurt its core processes, then that this would lead to the disintegration of our brain activity, and this in following would then lead to a disintegration of our mind, that as far at least as it is stored in here. And so this is, of course, a very tragic situation, because this body is a very frail medium. So it happens very quickly that we hurt it in a way that its core processes are damaged. And on the other hand, this dependence of our mind to our body really expresses a lack of portability, because, okay, I have storage media and they will someday die out. This happens, but then I want to try to copy the information to another storage medium, which will then endure further. And this is not so easy with this mind-body connection that we usually have. So this, again, this is the human body, for those who don't know it. So the idea evolved, maybe it would be quite nice if this mind thing was somehow independent from this body matter thing. So that's maybe how the idea of the soul developed. The soul as an eternal thing that is somewhat free from the constraints of the physical world. That is, if the body dies, then the soul goes into heaven, which is a beautiful, ideal garden of pure information, which is not torn down by all the constraints of the physical world, like, for example, information loss. And so this is actually a nice solution for people who can believe in it, but unfortunately there are many people who do not believe in heaven, so we have to look for other alternatives of how to keep this information process alive for a time that is maybe longer than just 30 years or so, if you have a very short-lived body. So now the first thing, of course, would be to look closer at our body shell and to research how it works and what makes it so frail. So, for example, evolution has optimized our body for certain things, like how to distribute our DNA code, but it has not actually optimized it so much for very great longevity. That is, we grow old, and our evolution does not care for people growing old, living longer and longer, because once they have fulfilled their task, like, for example, distributing their sperm, basically their task is done. So there's not much of self-repair mechanisms that are still very effective at a certain age. So if you look back at the last few centuries, we started with biotechnology and bioscience and biotechnology to understand a lot of that stuff and try to find out cures for some of the problems. And we've actually succeeded in lengthening our lifespan, not so much by building something new that in itself has a totally new substance that can live longer, so we did not totally reinvent the body, but we found more and more cures for example, diseases. So nowadays, in our cultural sphere, we can usually assume to live a little longer than our ancestors did. And so maybe we can make our body endure a longer and longer time. So this is basically what people like biogerontologist Aubrey de Grey argues, who says aging basically can be treated like a disease. So it's a collection of so you have damage accumulating in your body as you grow older, and you have certain mechanisms that start to fail that would usually repair this damage. So maybe we can use biotechnology to provide better repair mechanisms. And maybe we do not even need to reinvent the body totally, but we can piece by piece build more and more methods of rejuvenating parts of our body and thereby lengthen our lifespan for hundreds of years. Now, unfortunately, many scientists are of the opinion, okay, not everything that he says is total nonsense, but to assume that in our lifetime we could achieve something like that is. So maybe he's right, maybe he's not, but still we should look out for alternatives. Now, let's return to the idea of maybe we can make this mind thing independent from this body thing. And now I talked about the idea of soul, but of course the soul is not the only conceptualization of ourself as something that is not totally bound to our body, but actually there are other ideas of things that we usually call a part of ourselves that still seem in our cultural ideas to be able to survive our body. Like think, for example, of your reputation, of your honor, of your name. So, for example, you have, if you look back in history, you have great rulers, powerful men, and they were able to build monuments to themselves so that generations afterwards people would still remember their name, remember their face, remember the deeds they did. So they went down into the history books and they actually had the power and the resources to find a very strong and durable storage medium for one bit of information maybe of what the totality of their self would be. So in a way it's not very satisfying because you cannot store a whole lot of yourself in such a thing. You can basically store that which is politically useful. But your name or your reputation will, for example, not include things like your memories or your most inner thoughts or so on. And if you have a term for self that includes these, then even if you have the power to build something like that, it will not give you very much. And of course, it's totally unfair to people who are not powerful kings in those ages, because basically they will be forgotten a few generations after their offspring has died. So this is of course not the only way to store something of what goes on in your head in outside media. So for example, once we have something like writing, and writing really develops into something that is not just used by the powerful to store what taxes are collected, but it's actually something of a tool that you can use to record some of your thoughts to a greater depth. Then you, for example, have ancient philosophers starting to put a lot of their observations of the world, their thoughts, their arguments onto, I'm not quite sure, the papyrus or parchment or paper, but no matter, it's let's just say paper. And and the cool thing about, of course, about that is that these storage mediums in media in themselves are not as endurable maybe as this thing is, but still suddenly they have created a great portability for their mind, or at least a part of their mind. So if this what is written here is actually very interesting to people, they will start to copy it. People will read it, will copy it, and it's very easy to actually transfer this this amount of information to another piece of paper. And the very few very lucky, very mimetically successful guys actually were able to, in this way, move some of their thoughts forward to survive their body's death for thousands of years later. Like, for example, we can still buy books that include writings of Aristotle. And so in a way, he actually can still have conversations with us. So in a way, we can say, well, a piece of him, of the information that was determining who he is or what he himself maybe thought was important to him, is still surviving through time and has actually been moved to us nowadays. And now if you look at this idea of actually externalizing what goes on into your head, into a medium that can collect a bit more than just your name, then of course you have a huge explosion of that. The more literate people become, the more generally available writing equipment becomes and so on. So think of the last few centuries, suddenly people to a large degree start writing letters to each other, have diaries and so on. So this externalization of yourself into outside storage media is moving ahead. And now if we jump forward to nowadays, into the digital age, now it's actually possible to actually externalize everything you do. So you can have on anywhere you can first of all write everything down in a highly portable format that will then be distributed around the world and be saved in hard disks around the globe if it is of any interest to anyone. Second of all, even if you do not actively record everything you do, you can still be sure that people are watching you and have video cameras everywhere. And so maybe this is a positive twist to paranoia. You are recorded and will not go down without being remembered into history, because at least the Orwellian surveillance state will remember you. So here's an example, my Twitter account. I put all the not very important stuff in there. And if I do it very in a very fine-grained way, I actually can look back at what did I write a year ago and find out, oh, okay, this is actually quite an interesting look into my mind a year ago. So in a way, I can say that I can communicate with my own previous self from that time by, for example, wondering, why did I write this stupid nonsense or something like that? And also, of course, I can actually try to not only to record my mind, but actually to try to externalize some of the mechanisms of my mind into, for example, digital media. Like, for example, I have a wiki in which I record everything that I do, basically, and everything that moves into my mind, and it's publicly readable, so even if I'm outside of an outside world and I've forgotten my password, I can still access it. And so this is a great memory help. It actually, in a way, I don't need to memorize a lot of stuff if I know that I have it written into the internet, and hopefully I have backups if it gets deleted, because then I would really be fucked up without memory. And so, in a way, I hope that one day such a thing may bring myself a certain autonomy from my body. And, of course, this opens up many difficult philosophical questions like, is this really myself, if it is something that, for example, other people might be able to edit, and so on. But the general idea is, yes, it's not just this isolated information process in my head anymore, and it will all be lost if I die because nothing of it was ever put into another format. Now, this was the first thing that I wanted to look at. Now, the second thing that I want to look at is basically the reverse. That is, it's not so much about I have this idea thing and I want to record it in a physical thing, but actually, as I will show, it's the other way around. So, physical environments. Let's assume I really like this building and I really like the architecture. And this is, of course, all physical environment. The walls here or the chairs and the bodies of your people sitting in there, and maybe I say, oh, it would be great if my grandchildren would be able to still see this physical environment and see the imaginative quality of the architecture or something like that. So the problem, of course, is that I cannot be sure that in 100 years from now, actually, this all will still stand in this form, because nature is really evil and puts all these agents of change into the way of this being preserved forever. So think of stuff like erosion, fire, earthquakes. And actually, if you look at what human-made buildings actually survive for a long time, you have, of course, a few examples like the pyramids, but in general, most buildings that humans build are not built to last very long. And we actually maybe know how the pyramids looked like back then, even though they themselves are certainly a little bit eroded by now. But for example, how ancient cities of that time somewhere else looked, we have only very, very bad ruins left. So if I want to actually preserve something like some, let's say, configuration of an environment that I originally experienced as a physical, maybe storing it in its original physical instantiation is not the wisest choice, because this has a very short durability. So maybe another way would be to find a more portable format, like previously with the mind thing. Maybe I could put it out onto written media. Like, for example, I could write a description of a building. Now with the pyramids, this might be actually be quite easy at first sight, because it does not look like a very complex shape. But of course, I cannot actually put out a complete descriptions of the physical structure of the pyramids, because then I would have to describe every single stone and every single atom in that stone, and this would provide for a very large book. And so instead, I have to look for ways that may be more useful in preserving a useful image from which, for example, I could once reconstruct the pyramids. So the next idea would be maybe pictures. So for example, here's a photograph of the Palast der Republik, which is an old GDR building that originally stood in Berlin and was then torn down by the triumphant Western society. And we still have photographs left of it. So you see, of course, here that it is quite detailed. I can learn a lot about the building from these photographs. But still, it's not really perfect, because I unfortunately only have one single central perspective at one time of one day in the 20th century. So, for example, I do not know what the other side of the building looked like, or whether on the left side anything goes on, how large is the building also. So actually one single picture of a building is neither a very useful representation of a physical environment that could be used to reconstruct it. Now, the obvious solution, of course, is to multiply the number of images. So I can have many different images of an object from many different viewpoints at many different times of day. And we, in our digital age, where we now have people constantly making photographs of everything on every part of the world, for example, if we take the Eiffel Tower as example, we actually have a situation where this is true. So if you give, if you write Eiffel Tower into the search mask at Flickr, you will get thousands of images from all possible points of views at all daytimes, and I guess every single screw that is in the Eiffel Tower is actually pictured in one of these pictures. So it would be actually possible to reconstruct the Eiffel Tower if it was suddenly torn down. Now, but this problem is like a continuous series of two-dimensional images, and it's still not very satisfying. For example, a reconstruction of the Eiffel Tower, even if certainly cannot just be a series of images. So I'm very interested in actually people, for example, trying to create 3D reconstructions of environments. So the first thing that came to my mind is movie sets. In very old and very cheap movies, it's the easiest solution is, of course, to just have some drawn background and put actors in front of it. And this might suffice for a certain goal. But if you have a very expensive movie, then people are actually tempted to waste the money on things like actually rebuilding huge three-dimensional sets. Like, for example, here we have the ruins of the Forum Romanum. And there is this HBO BBC TV series Rome from 2005, which is... whose topic is basically the fall of the Republic in ancient Rome. And they actually rebuilt the original Forum Romanum at, I think, 60% of its original size. And so they are very proud in their TV series with, oh, we have real, really huge, real physical sets. It's not like we only use CGI like cheaper people would do. We actually rebuilt it so that, for example, our actors can really feel how it was in ancient Rome, and that they can turn around in 360 degrees, and that they can get lost in the alleys of Rome. And of course, this is all the propaganda that they did do in the making of, and in the promotion material, and in the audio commentaries, basically arguing that this is great way of actually reliving the past experience, and offers actors talking about, yes, you could really walk around in the set and feel lost there, and you would really wonder whether you could go, whether you would find back into the present world, and so on. And one can argue, of course, about the authenticity ideology behind that, and also about the accuracy that it was actually rebuilt in. But I think the main problem with this is that as a storage medium for a past 3D environment, it is again a physical thing, and thereby suffers the problems of physical things. So what happened? The series ended when the set burned down by accident. So another solution maybe would be to have 3D environments that are not tied to the properties of matter that much. So, for example, we have this in video games. Now, video games, from the ego perspective, of course, use 3D environments. Of course, they are projected on a two-dimensional screen, but you have all the freedom of movement in a three-dimensional environment, of changing your perspective, that you would not have in a two-dimensional projection, as we saw in the picture of the Palace de République. And you actually have games that actually not just invent something totally arbitrarily, but actually try, for example, to give you a sense of a certain historical situation. Like, for example, we have here Medal of Honor, and you have a level that is basically the Normandy invasion of 1944, very much modeled after the opening scene of Steven Spielberg's Saving Private Ryan. So you actually can run through Omaha Beach and be shot, I think it's very hard to beat this level. I think you get shot most of the times by German machine guns. So your sense of freedom of movement may be a little reduced, but still you have this situation that you actually have some people trying to rebuild a historical space. And another place where I find it is, for example, in the Grand Theft Auto series in a way, because in Grand Theft Auto you have, of course, fictional cities like Liberty City or Vice City, which are very obviously modeled on real cities. For example, in Vice City, sorry, I have to take some water. Stupid human matter body with its stuff. This is basically not just a rebuild of Miami, but it's of course a creatively imagined Miami, but it's also interesting because it's basically based on representations of Miami in 1980s popular fiction like Miami Vice, the TV series, or the Brian De Palma movie Scarface. So as a player, you actually have walked through a sort of a historical representation of a city. Like you would do, and I think that's the closest that we get to the holodeck simulations of past periods that you would see in Star Trek Next Generations, which also were, of course, mostly gaming environments. And, of course, this idea of using Grand Theft Auto to store snapshots of historical snapshots of cities is, for example, used by the people of GTA Berlin, which I think the people are actually based at a sea base in Berlin, and they try to rebuild Berlin as a Grand Theft Auto environment. And they actually spend a lot of detailed work in rebuilding buildings and having discussions about, okay, what belongs in there, what does not belong in there. For example, I once stumbled upon a discussion, does the Palast der Republik actually belong in there? Because the Palast der Republik actually got torn down very recently. In the last decade, that is in the early zeros, and now they want to put something else in there, which originally stood there. So the city fortress. So it's a very interesting question: what does it belong to a historical snapshot of Berlin? This building, which does not stand anymore, or the city fortress that they want to erect on the empty space that they want now built there? So actually have a lot of what do we archive questions in there. But anyway, this is all just, of course, you could argue this is just gaming environments and this is not really useful as snapshots of a reality. Of course, the one real thing that comes into your mind if you think about snapshots of physical environments is, of course, nowadays all the series of Google Maps, Google Earth, and Google Street View products. So I guess you're all familiar with them in a way, but just to remind you what they actually are. They first start with having a two-dimensional super photograph of the whole planet Earth, and then they add additional information to, like, for example, altitude and actually three-dimensionality. Like here we see inside of cities they actually put three-dimensional shapes in there that are to represent buildings. So it's not just a top-down view, it's actually three-dimensionality added. The facades of the buildings put as textures on the surfaces of these building blocks, etc. And then, of course, you also have Google Street View, which also adds this. You have at every point of every street of major cities, 360 degrees panoramic views of everything. So if you add all that together, you really have a huge amount of data stored about a physical environment, which is basically the entire human planet Earth. And now the problem with Google Earth, etc., is of course that this is never an accurate snapshot of the present. Actually, it's always a snapshot of the past. So maybe you know the problem that you see buildings on maps that are actually no more at that place because they were torn down, or actually there is only an empty space and in the meantime a building was erected there. So of course Google only can at one point of time make a photograph before maybe one day they send out video drones that will record everything in real time, but not right now. And so they have often this problem that it's not updated. So they have to regularly update the data and put out new images. And that is interesting because now suddenly you do not have only one snapshot of one present, but you actually have several snapshots of several presents. So at first I was worried, what will Google do with all this old material? Will this just disappear? Then I found on Google Earth that there is actually now a time slider where you can actually scroll through different time periods of a certain image data of a physical environment. Like, for example, here we see September 12th of 2001. So this is New York, and this is, of course, the smoke that comes up from Ground Zero. Now, obviously, this was not an image that you could originally see on Google Maps back then, because I think Google Maps didn't even exist back then. But still, of course, they added more historical material, because obviously they like that idea that you are actually not just moving three-dimensionally in a physical environment that is one snapshot at one point in time, but that you are actually able to move four-dimensionally, that is, forwards and backwards in time. This finds its extreme in, for example, if you go to Rome in Google Earth, you can actually add a layer of ancient Rome as it is reconstructed from what people assume it looked like in 320 AD. Reconstructing ancient Rome seems to be like the supreme art of reconstructing physical environments. Yeah, it's a lot of more of, we have rebuilt Rome in 3D and you can walk through it software out on the market. But what this all means now is that we have actually a huge amount of stored data about physical environments that can be used much better to reconstruct physical environments than it would be the case if we just had a written description of the pyramids, like for example. So all this data is now available to us, and we can use it for interesting stuff. Like, for example, this is a screenshot from the augmented reality app Layar. Now, this is a smartphone, so there's a camera built in, and I can use this actually to see what the camera sees. So I can use it as a sort of window to you people, which would be stupid because I can see you with my own eyes just as well. But augmented reality applications add additional information to that. Like, for example, they would put names on objects, or if you were all in some way identified, it would show me the names of you floating over your head. And now these augmented reality apps do stuff like also, if you go to Ground Zero, you can actually add a layer which will show you the World Trade Center that originally stood there. So I'm standing in front of Ground Zero, and instead of seeing flat space, I can use this to look up into the heaven and see the World Trade Center rise again. And there's other stuff like that, like, for example, in Berlin, you can actually have your view blocked by the Berlin Wall. And so what this all amounts to is, I think, for this, that this creates a bubble of a four-dimensional bubble that we can, of the whole planet Earth, starting at a certain point of time, through which we can move with great immediacy into all directions. That is, I can on my computer, of course, visit every place on Earth, on Google Maps and Earth, and now I can also jump as far back as this image data is stored in it. So suddenly the past is not something that is very unavailable and is only in very frail and small portions preserved, but is actually, as it can be seen with as great an immediacy as I see everything of the present in my digitally augmented world nowadays. So actually, if some event happens and I'm too lazy to attend it, I can just say it makes no difference whether I go there now or whether I later look at the records. I'm actually now in this four-dimensional bubble of total freedom where no information ever gets lost and where I can move around into all directions and where basically I'm free of this horrible being time that tries to dictate what information is available to me and what is not. Now, this view, of course, of the past as something totally available is quite the contrary to how we usually experience something like history. That is, history, in many ways, is the study of a past that is unattainable, or a past that can only be deduced by very few physical artifacts that are still left nowadays, and from which we have to construct narratives to fill many, many holes about areas that we have, unfortunately, no data preserved that came from the past to us now. So, for example, This is like, for example, the Dead Sea Scrolls. If our access to the past is based on stuff like that, this is quite bad compared to the amount of data that we have about the life on our planet 3 years ago, thanks to Google, for example. So there is a lot more of stuff where we have actually holes that we have to fill with our with logic, with speculation, and so on, with interpretation. So we value these artifacts of the past very greatly, because something like that, which is roughly 2,000 years old, it can be quite proud to have survived for so long, even in such a bad shape. And so we give it an honorful place in a protected form. But of course, what's really interesting to us is the information that we can retrieve from this. So on the one hand, we want to preserve this object, but on the other hand, we will scan it in and then have copies that are very portable as compared to that. You don't want to give that to every scientist who maybe wants to decipher it and give it to him back at home where his children play with it. But you actually want to have a copy of the information stored on there that you can reach around safely and that will not get the original destroyed. So we harvest this for information and put this information on storage media that may be not as endurable, but we can be sure that this information is somewhat safe because now it is very portable and there are many, many, many copies of it. Then when we harvest the information, we of course have to do a lot of text critical work with it. So for example, many old texts, we cannot just assume that we can read them right away, even if we know the alphabet and even if we know some of the language, there will be many parts that we will have to deduce by logic or speculation, and which can only be strengthened a little in their truth value by comparing it with other knowledge that we have about the time. And now the problem, of course, is the more that our knowledge is actually based not on on real physical artifacts, but on text that is the result of other text, that is the result of other text, the less sure we can be about is there actually at the bottom some reality to it, to what we are actually researching. Of course, if we have an image of history that is more and more just text that is of dubious reality, like we have for many periods of very ancient history, where we can only just say, okay, we assume this might be true, but we cannot be absolutely sure because we have too few data, then we have more and more a text that cannot claim any more respect than any fictional text can claim. So, for example, that's the reason why I really love a movie like 300. 300 is, of course, a movie that many people did not like, but I actually really liked it, and I think that one of the things that you cannot use against 300 is the claim that it is historically inaccurate, because what you have in 300 is basically a movie that tries to reinvent a time for which we cannot do anything else but reinventing it. So we have too few data left to actually provide a realistic counterpoint to what we see in this hyper-stylized hyper-fictional feeling movie like 300. So, and actually the more outrageous parts are taken verbatim from authors of that time who made adventurous claims that we cannot really prove. So we have to actually accept that someone makes a movie out of it that actually works with the material as is the only way that we can work with the material, that is in a certain way that is very speculative, highly inventive, and that does not actually try to project too many assumptions of our own reality back to that, because I think that is actually what makes a movie like 300 relatively honest compared to other historical pictures about the period, that in its stylized and highly artificial and highly feeling fictional form, it's actually very honest about what we can actually do with the material. So I've seen other history movies which try to give you the feeling that the people back then lived according to the same laws of nature as we did, and where this had the same psychology and so on. And that, of course, is actually not what you can be sure about, because the past is so out of your reach in that case that you can only speculate from text knowledge about it, and not so much from what is actually can be reached by your own hands and be tested in the laboratory, whether it actually was that way, so that you can, for example, falsify stuff. Now, to treat history in this way as some kind of text that does not demand the respect that we have for any sort of truth is, for example, what I find very beautifully done on the website TV Tropes. Is anyone familiar with TV Tropes? Okay, so TV Tropes is a website which basically tries to collect patterns that occur in popular fiction, mostly in TV series, in video games, in anime, in world wrestling narratives, and so on, but also in literature and in opera, if some people are actually expert enough in these matters that they can add to this material. And so they develop lots of patterns that are common in fiction, and then they, for each work that they encounter, they will give you a list of this and this and this pattern occurs in this work of fiction, and it's maybe it's affirmed in this point, in this work of fiction, or it's subverted because they do something very clever with this cliché or something like that. And now they, of course, also use it for history. So if you have Gaius Julius Caesar, I find out what many patterns of popular fiction this character fits. And they do not even try to give the assumption that, okay, in reality it was like that, but of course in the fictionalized version it was like that. They basically treat most of it as, actually, Caesar fits perfectly into fiction. So maybe we can just handle him as we do handle fiction. And so you also have a more liberal and playful attitude toward history that, for example, I think you also find realized in something like alternate history novels, like Kim Stanley Robinson's novel on the left, which claims that, or claims its scenario is that the Great Plague destroyed Europe in the Middle Ages, so the world had to be distributed between basically the most powerful groups are then the Arabs, the Indians, and the Chinese, or on the right, 1632, whose premise is that some American small town gets suddenly transported back into the Germany of the 30-year war, and how this changes history. And now this, of course, is openly fiction. They do not doubt that history actually went on differently, and actually I think the authors would very much say that what they do is educate us about the history that we know and that we also claim to know with a certain truth value, but there are others. So, I forgot that I had this picture, so I shortly want to say something about that. If we really share this assumption that history is just text and that all the physical artifacts are just actually present-day artifacts that cannot actually say us something about the past because the past is not reachable to us and we can only actually construct the past, invent it as text, then we should, I think, for example, raise things like the ruins of ancient Athens because they only give a false sense of authenticity. Like, okay, we send tourists there and they can say, oh, I'm walking through the same place that maybe Socrates walked through, which is, of course, a very bold claim because there is not much left of this reality that they can actually draw this connection. They actually only see some numbers of buildings, and very few of them, I think, would share a critical attitude that actually would agree that we can know so few about this area that we cannot just freely walk through and imagine ourselves to be in that past suddenly just by touching the stone of the ruins and so on. So maybe we should just digitalize this, scan it in, and then tore it down to make place for a parking lot or something. This would then give us a more realistic approach to what we really know about the past. And so this way of thinking is found, for example, in authors that we would see called Chronologiekritik in German. And they're all very, I think no real historian accepts anything of what they say, but the way they argue their arguments is very interesting. So, for example, Heribert Illich, he claims that certain centuries of the Middle Ages were just invented, and Anatoly Fomenko is even more radical. He basically claims that all that we know seem to know about past history pre-15th century is invented by some Renaissance forgeries and so on. And now the interesting thing about this is, if you look, for example, at Fomenko, the way that he argues it is basically he treats history only just as text. And he says, I can now use this text and have some information information processing algorithms go over it. Some of my mathematics and statistics, because Fomenko is originally a mathematician. And then I find interesting patterns that actually give me the assumption that, for example, some people who are claimed to be different people and who are claimed to have lived thousands of years apart actually have a very similar sounding name and actually have participated in battles that sound very much the same and maybe have written the books with that sound very much the same. So maybe they are just one and the same person and all these thousands of years between them is just invention. And that's basically the way that he argues his stuff. And the interesting thing is, the good thing about his work is, I think, that he's, even though some of his arguments are somewhat stupid, like arguing that Cicero, if he is depicted in a 15th century painting in 15th century clothing, might have lived in the 15th century. But other stuff really is good at finding weak corners in where history actually is constructed just as text, where there is a lot of stuff that is just textual speculation and that we commonly accept as, well, it has to have been that way. There would be no other explanation for what we have left from that area. And so he's very effective at destroying this security that we claim to have about many areas of history. The first large problem with his work is that he then tries to construct an alternate history that is even much more unbelievable than the most strange areas that he finds out in our conventional history. And also that, and now I take another sip of water. And now the other problem, of course, is that history, even though I just gave you a position of how to maybe argue that history is just text, is not just text. So he actually has to deal with physical artifacts that are dated by methods of physics to find out how old they are, how they are dated. So think, like, for example, of radiocarbon dating. And now the problem he has with that is, of course, that it actually affirms the traditional chronology that we have. Like, for example, there were the Romans, and they lived 700-something BC till, since they collapsed something like the 5th century. Such a thing is what he doubts, and now suddenly we find some artifact from that time, and people who are good in, for example, dating via radiocarbon dating or dendrochronology, which is dating wood based on this tree ring analysis, they argue, well, actually, this is really proves that it is that old. It's not just some textual invention. So what he argues is that actually, in defense of his hypothesis, that text is actually supreme to physics. So that all these, say, physical dating methods are nice and good if you want to date something, if you want to know whether something is 100 million years old or 100 million years old, but it's not really of use if you want to know whether something is 500 years older or younger. So he claims that for the time that it is usually used for by historians, it was actually, of course, calibrated according to the old traditional chronology. Thereby, only the physical methods will only affirm this old chronology. So the only way to get out of that is basically to recalibrate it, maybe according to his own chronology. But what we see here, of course, is that there is actually a reason for historians to keep the physical artifacts as storage of the past, because they are the only anchor that we have towards the past that can actually still prove anything. If we actually do what I said earlier about raising the agora and just scanning it in, and then we actually only have just text, and then we can play any way with it as we want, but we have no knowledge about past at all anymore, then we really must accept that we only live in the present, which would maybe fit well with the whole Google world that I just showed, because in there everything is present. Everything is present that we have data on, and everything that we do not have data on is the past that in itself cannot be reached because it is outside of our scope. So what we get close to is, of course, the questions of actually what can be found out physically and information. So for example, how we can find out whether something is old from physics, or how much how actually information is stored in physical bodies, and how this information stored therein maybe get lost. And so to give you an example of ways of thinking about this question, let's go to Pierre Laplace and his demon. He had a thought experiment that a being that would be able to know the total present state of the universe, that is every single atom, would be able to actually by that also know every past and every future state of the universe. This makes sense if you assume certain things like determinism and reversibility of everything, that everything is part of a very clear and non-ambiguous chain of cause and effect. Unfortunately, in the last, 200 years or so, a large part of thinking that this was possible broke down. We have all this crazy stuff like like quantum mechanics now, and of entropy and of irreversibility. So this idea that by just knowing the present state of the universe, we could know all the states in the past and the future is, of course, even back then it was just a thought experiment, and it was not something that one thought would be possible. But if it was, it would be really beautiful, because it would solve all our archiving problems at once, because we would not need to archive any information, because we would just need to create something that would know the total present state of the universe, and then could just ask this machine how something looked like. Other problem would be, of course, that this machine would have to be part of our universe, and then we have all this problem that we cannot be at the same time the observer and blah. Anyway, this is just a thought experiment that has been disproven. Give you another point. Now we had this whole thing about how the mind works. Now, and I talked a lot about this preservation of self. Now, what I did not yet mention was the idea of the mind upload. So it's a popular futuristic idea that you can just, of course, I mentioned different ways. Maybe you can outsource a lot of your thinking into digital media and so on. But still, you can never claim that this really absorbs all of the stuff that goes on into your brain. And maybe you really do not want to lose any of that. So actually what you want is to really find out a way to get all this thing that happens in your brain out into a computer simulation, where it, of course, would be much more portable and could be copied and so on. Now, the problem with that is, how do you do that? And now there is a brute force approach that you could maybe use, according to futurists, which is basically, of course, maybe we do not really know so much about how the brain works, but we know that at the lowest end of it, we have the physical laws acting, and we have organic material that is made up of atoms and so on. So maybe we can just, with super modern nanotechnology, scan everything in a snapshot, atom by atom. And if we then have the snapshot and put it into a computer simulation of the laws of physics, then we would just have to hit the start button. And as this snapshot of nature would do the same work as it would do in the outside material world, then in this computer simulation, still consciousness should emerge. Now, we can argue about the possibility of doing this snapshot atom by atom thing. But let's just assume that this is possible with super nanotechnology. But there are still people then who argue, okay, that would not be enough. Like, for example, Roger Penrose, a physicist, argues maybe this is not enough, because all the super cool stuff about how our consciousness emerges may actually take place even deeper in the whole quantum craziness level of physics. And it would not be able to simulate that with our deterministic computers. So these are some examples of the problem of actually retrieving and storing information from matter, and somehow making it independent from one instantiation of matter. And maybe, as you have already seen in the last three or four minutes of me talking about it, I'm really no expert in all of that. I'm actually really, really bad at physics, and I use the terminology wrongly and so on. So the problem is that of this Penrose guy, I never finished reading his physics introductory bestseller, 1100 pages, this thing. So about all the other stuff, about cosmological limits of information storage, I can only give you a superficial overview of what I found with a quick Wikipedia search. Of stuff that I do not understand. So there seems to be, for example, this area of digital physics, thinking that the universe could actually be seen as some sort of digital computing process. And if you have such a thing, such as the universe being something like a physical computing process, then you could, of course, think about how much how large a computer you would need to actually copy that and to continue the simulation and to store it. So we come to nice quantities, like you would need for the entire universe 10 to the power of 90 bits or so. And the problem then being that you cannot just build a computer in the universe that would fit into the universe that could have so much information processing capabilities. So maybe we would have to find actually an outside position doing something like that, actually leaving the laws of physics that we know to be able to do something like realize the thought experiment of the Laplace demon. Or the other cool thing that I found is that there seems to be this guy, Frank J. Tipler, who basically argues that, according to the Wikipedia article at least, that one day all the universe will basically emerge into a larger and larger intelligence machinery, and then in that machinery it will be possible to run all the previous states of the universe, and so also all the people that ever existed. So we basically have the Christian resurrection of the dead. And so this would basically be the cool thing again, that we do not have to care now for how do we archive stuff, because the future will take care of reconstructing everything, and the future will be able to reconstruct everything, and we can just go on living our life without worrying about it, because one day we will actually go up into that sort of heaven where the laws of nature do no more hinder us in having all information available that there ever was. And this is my end.
Okay, questions for Christian? Yep.
So do you think Google is trying to be Laplace's demon?
I think there are many smart minds at Google who probably have thought about the theoretical maxima of what they are able to do, and I think they do not really think that it would be possible. But to a certain degree, yes, not in the absolute sense of really reconstructing the universe atom by atom, but certainly by really exploding the amount of data that is available about the present, and thereby also being able to deduce almost everything about the past, at least as much as now our historians can do.
One more. So you said, you know, maybe there's this omega point thing that's going to happen when a universe-encompassing computer creates simulations of everything that's going on. So what are the odds that we're actually in a simulated universe right now?
Oh, I'm really too stupid to answer that question.
Okay.
Can I just make a comment about Google? I think the Google perspective is only one word, money. They don't care two hoots about what else is going on. And every organic form or non-organic form in the universe is actually Google's commodity. So we are all their commodity, and your every single digital and non-digital presence in the universe is being tracked down to the last dot, unless somebody will voice and make noise and say stop doing this because we don't like it, like the Google Waves, you know, the bus and all that. The project is being killed because you basically, you know, they look into your privacy more than what is required. So for them, the universe is a big experimental machine to derive ultimately after XYZ and 1,000 or 1 million steps, as far as all computer is able to do all the calculation, which they have no fear because they build their own hardware, etc.
So, could you repeat that? I think I did not fully follow the last part.
The last part is talking about, you know, whether they are able to do all the calculation, the simulation. Yes, I say yes, because hardware is no limitation to them. They will just build it, and if they find something that is insufficient for their purpose, they will purpose build it, which has been evident till now. So into the future, with the past precedents, what can they do with this kind of thing? And it's only computation and nothing else, because collecting data is their forte. So if you want to be their commodity, you keep using them. If you don't want their commodity, there are just many ways to avoid a search. Sorry, I make this kind of statement.
Well, if...
because it's so interesting listening to you, so
thank you. Well, but I think if being their commodity means that I suddenly I'm able to live in this four-dimensional super real bubble where everything is present and I have everything, every information at my fingertips, then I have no problem being a commodity of Google.
If you think you want to live in a Riemann space or Hilbert space, it's fine. But if you want to live in a, shall I coin this new word, called Google space, it's also fine because it's your choice. So I think the powers become more than quartz theory can absorb, you know, in quantum physics. Hmm.
So, any more?
Yes, I have a question. The problem is what I see in with Google Maps and 3D buildings and so on. That's just all that's next to a street. So everything, and then maybe a few things like Niagara Falls and so on. But it's not the whole world. The whole world is more bigger and as we can imagine, and I think that's just very little data in real life. Mm-hmm. So it's not, yeah.
Of course, you have different resolution for different areas of the world, different areas of interest. Mm-hmm. I think I would argue that Google provides a nice foundation for a lot of stuff, like even of the more remote areas you have low resolution satellite images, and that to provide a greater resolution can in a way be the project of people who are interested in it. That is, if you live in a small village and you actually want Google Street View there, you have to create your own. The problem with that, of course, from a power perspective, is that Google basically sets the standard, and you cannot go back before that. You just can add to it, so you cannot subtract from it. So you will not be able to put the areas which are so mapped so detailed back into being mapped low resolution. But it's always possible to go with other areas to higher resolution.
So then there may be the possibility that if this computer tries and reconstructs our present state based on what it gets from Google, that like the developing world will be really fuzzy, but we'll have really good pictures of the streets out here. That seems just, I don't know, sort of strange. In fact, I lived in Cambodia the last 2 years, and at one point the Prime Minister of Cambodia criticized and wrote a letter to Google saying that they were misrepresenting the sovereignty of Cambodia because they were showing the border between Cambodia and Thailand based on wrong and inaccurate maps, and you know that they had proved in the world court in the 1960s that such and such a border is obtained. I think it's really funny that they went to Google as the authority and said, you're misrepresenting this. You should be better than this.
I also think what you said about basically the rich areas get represented very well, the poor areas don't, which is, of course, mirroring the old stuff that I said about if you are a king and ruler, then you have the resources to build large monuments to yourself, whereas as a peasant, you are basically lost. So in a way, you cannot just shake off this hierarchy. You still can argue that you are much better represented now than you would have been in the past, but still the others are much better represented. The interesting thing about being able to being well represented enough to be reconstructed, of course, is that there are I had this guy who, and I'm really not qualified to talk very deeply about it, but I remember, for example, the science fiction novel Accelerando by Charles Stross, where there is a major plot point that people in the future get resurrected based on the data that is available on them. And so you basically have this problem. If you are very well represented and very accurately, then you get resurrected in a very good and accurate way. But if you are half fiction and there's a lot of misinformation about you, then you're fucked.
So then our future resurrection depends on our search profile.
Not only that, I would add, for example, what I do is, of course, this whole I upload my entire life onto the internet will provide lots of accurate information to reconstruct me for our future alien overlords.
That's interesting. So you can possibly change yourself. What you don't want to have in the future when you be resurrected, you just ignore or change, yeah?
Yeah, of course, I'm all the time in some way defining myself who I am. And of course, the more I have available information resources of determining who I am by myself, the more power I have over myself as opposed to, for example, Google deciding who I am. Then, of course, the question is how available all that is. So if Google de-indexes my site, then I may be just a Google profile because this information is not valid to them reconstructing people.
I mean, I have the problem that from time to time people want to interview me. And at the same time, I know I prefer the way to answer interviews via email, because I can think a lot about what I'm writing and can be very precise, and that's how I like to be represented. That's why I'm writing that whole stuff. One example is that I worked like almost a week on a really detailed interview, and it was published yesterday. The first thing that happened is that they didn't ask me about my picture, and it took one picture just from the internet from somewhere. It's so incredibly horrible. It's the first thing that's there. It's me like with one eye looking to this direction, one eye looking to this direction. I look horrible. I look like a zombie. It's horrible. And fuck, I did everything that I could do to make myself look cool, and the internet just like fucks it up. Okay. And whatever, I mean, that's what I have to, I mean, there are pictures of me and they took some picture that's like Creative Commons, they took it. I could of course write them, please change the image, but then again, I'm not too narcissistic about that. So, but that happens. I mean, my future resurrection will be the one, will be that one, yeah? And I can't do anything against it, yeah? Secondly, a good friend of mine, Cory Doctorow, he has an ongoing process running that he is recording all, he's pretty much like recording, like not recording in an audio way, but he's pretty much like he has a process running on his machine that is in detail monitoring which songs he's hearing, which TV programs he's watching on his notebook, what text he's writing, for example, which line of text for his new book he was writing, and what music he was listening while he was writing it. So he will be in the future, it will be possible for him in the future to see, okay, I wrote that line, I wrote that book, and I was really into like new metal when I did this. And why was that? So he's trying to save all the data of his like creative process to make it impossible in the future to analyze himself with all this data. I was eating this, I was ordering that, I listened to that music, and I used that font when I was typing, because that's all like about myself, yeah.
That's actually really fascinating, given So I worked for an intellectual historian, and so he, you know, the whole thing that he did was like trying to get inside the head of like 15th and 16th century scholars. And like he does things like reconstructing their libraries to find out everything they had access to, and going through their diaries and piecing together what were the steps that led to the discovery where they proved that Hermes Trismegistus didn't actually date from the time of Moses and was actually just some guy from 400 AD. And what's really interesting is there's this huge gap in terms of the records we have once people invent the telephone, because there are no traces of that except if you say, write me a memo. And so we have text, and then this huge blank for like a large part of the 20th century, and then, you know, with some archives here and there. And now what we're having is things like the Twitter archive, and what Cory Doctorow is doing is that intellectual historians of the future are going to be awesome at what they do. And I'm really excited about that.
But they will not be human.
Ah, that's true. So they'll be even better at what they do.
Sorry. Oh. No, actually, talking about the comment that Johannes was just making about people recording all their whole life. Okay, if you are like apart from your real physical life, you know, if you are like 24 hours sticking to this machine, and your log is actually, you can reconstruct the log into a kind of a batim to record what have you done. Because the log, every single second, you know, I open this file and I change the font, I do this, I do that, you know, and then 20 minutes interval because I went to the restroom and have three cakes, you know, or talk to someone. And you know simultaneously you are on Facebook, Twitter, or what. But what it cannot do is your concurrent activity in your head. Mm-hmm. You know, the how many synapses are going out, coming in, destroy, put in the long-term memory or short-term memory, or throw it out. You know, how many sorting routine you are doing while you are looking at that guy, say that, you know, 5 hours ago he was blah, 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 like that, and with 20 other guys. This human mind is incredible because you can do all this concurrently, where the machine cannot. You see, even how extensive you can put minus, minus, minus all your activity, that it will sort it out by itself. You know, all the minus, you know what I'm talking. So what is your comment on, you know, like reconstructing log? At least that give you like a huge part of your activity on the machine. But what's in the brain, we'll leave it to some mind scientists and neurologists.
Well, to me, that's just a resolution problem. So it's very low resolution what I have here. It's just what outpowers from my head and realizes itself in something that I find important enough to write it down. And of course, my degree of importance is now much lower than for other, what it would be for other people. But still, if I would try to write down every breath I take, then I would not have time to actually live my life. So actually, I would, first of all, I would need machines that do record it for me and write it down for me. And secondly, then of course I still have the problem that what goes on inside my head is hard to store. The one solution would of course be this mind snapshot thing, which we can argue about whether it would actually work. And the other is what I find interesting, a friend of mine does something like that, that is he also has a wiki where he tries to store everything that goes through his mind as something that might be worth recording. And he really does it for the mind upload, in a way. So he really thinks about how would it be possible to make this whole thing autonomous and give it a life of its own, for example. And so he tries to actually record, get his thoughts closer to what is recorded on the wiki. But he does it the other way around. That is, he uses a very formalistic language in its wiki, which with lots of kennel case writing that is indecipherable in its meaning to outside observers who do not know what special terms he uses and so on. Which is optimized to being being read, being machine readable. And so he says that now he's more and more actually thinking in the way that he writes his wiki. So his solution to making his brain and a computer compatible is actually trying to think more like a computer.
So shortly after he bought his typewriter, Nietzsche wrote, "Our writing tools are also working on ourselves." And so, you know, maybe the answer is if we the people who are more machine readable will be better preserved, or maybe you could just do all of your work in an fMRI machine, and it could scan all of what you're doing all the time, and have that done. I guess sort of the whole idea of textual interpretation and reconstructing mentalities and stuff is that what if, you know, if maybe more information isn't the answer. Maybe we just need the right pieces of information. The whole idea from psychoanalysis that it may be the smallest thing. It may be something completely unintentional that you drop in that's the key to your personality. And so I have no idea what the machines are going to think of me or what they're going to think of this conversation because it's being recorded and it's going to be part of the great mass of information. But maybe we'll all be in love with our parents or something when we're reconstructed. I have no idea.
I think the interesting point about this, maybe it's just a small information, is of course the question of how much complexity do we actually assume is to be found in the human mind. And of course then you have to differentiate between stuff that goes very high level stuff, where you actually verbalize things and are actually conscious that you are verbalizing them, and low-level stuff like, for example, regulating your breathing. Now, this actually also may be regulated by your brain, but maybe you would not consider it as essential to being to your reconstruction, that it fits exactly the same pattern. So maybe the solution is just throwing off a very strict definition of what the self is that has to involve a lot of stuff that you cannot record. So be content with actually what you can record, and by that definition, of course, you could even say that's something like the ancient Greek philosophers did a mind upload, and we are now reconstructing everything that is essential about them, and their private life, their sex life, or maybe something like that, is totally irrelevant, and they would not have wanted us to reconstruct it anyway. And the other alternative is, of course, to, and that's maybe why I tried to integrate something like that, is that this basically argues that, like the Laplace thing, if we assume that one day such a demon would be possible, as some kind of meta-universe entity or something that we invent once we have transcended the universe by becoming super intelligent gods or something like that, then it would be possible for such an intelligence to reconstruct everything that was previously there without it having needed an effort to preserve it. So no matter how much we try to archive now, it would not matter. Even the stuff that we try not to archive would still be found by reverse engineering, basically, the output of the universe, and then finding every previous state. So this is that's why I mentioned this, because this is a very beautiful idea in contrast to the we have to actually put effort into preserving everything. Yeah. Any more questions?
So, any more questions? If not, then I would say that Thomas and I will host a short roundup, I would call it. So, and okay, then. Nobody. Okay, big applause for Christian Heller. Yes. Woo! Too bad that Herbert Rachowitz is not here any longer, but at least Jana and Christian are still here. So let's try to have like another 20 minutes or something like that, roundup, open discussion, and I hope that we will not do all the talking and the microphone will already be like wandering around and jump from mind to mind, I hope. Okay, any initial statements? Or no, maybe, Thomas, you should do the initial statement.
Well, maybe I think I start with an observation or a question, maybe, that most of the talks, in a way, circled around the idea of how to narrate this approach towards how to modulate between mind and matter. That very often during the talks I had mind and matter, mind or matter, mind versus matter even. So I think that one direction when we think about preservation, which is something that's very close to the idea of why we keep something like an archive into the air, is how do we modulate and moderate these two things? And when I think about Rachowitz's talk, I had the impression that it was something like coming back to the idea of semiotics in the end, that we're still debating basic semiotics of a social framework, what an archive could be. Is this a real place? Is this something like an open space of something like an intellectual manufactory or something like that? So I had the idea that maybe that's something we will, in a way, come closer tomorrow. But a lot of the movement, another term from the talks of today, was towards the idea how to modulate between mind and matter. And it, in a way, whenever text is mentioned, there's this idea of narration floating around. So I think that the flow I like the idea of the illusion. I'm not familiar with Indian philosophy, but I think that this idea of a flow is something, I think, very close to a Western understanding of narration. So maybe that's a point to start or come back or try to tie all the talks of today together. Maybe you'd like to start because you referred to text a lot and your approach wasn't a very positive one towards text.
Oh, I like text, and text is much more portable and much more flexible than the material world. One can play around with it much better. And I actually like the idea of the world basically disintegrating into text, and because that gives me much more freedom. Whereas I find it, I find more the physical world as a sort of baggage that I have to ballast. Don't know the English word I have to carry around with me, which keeps me from freely flying around everywhere and seeing every moment in the universe. But of course, these moments that I wanted to see in the universe would of course be moments in the physical universe. So again, maybe there is something to be said for the non-text world as well. So.
I was going towards the idea of semiotics. Maybe I didn't necessarily notice this, because actually I don't. The issue of mind and matter does not really touch me, because I believe in the body subject, which makes it easy for me, because then I would look at mind and matter as discourses which have, of course, certain effects, but not necessarily as a division according to which it would make sense to divide the world and its phenomena into, because that's just the basic assumption. If there are in the phenomenon you have both something that appears and an instance that perceives. Therefore, I put that, and I talked to Herbert Rachowitz about this. I put mind and matter on my slides in the beginning, but this did not mean to suggest that either that I believe in a possible division or the impossibility of a division. Rather, I wondered whether it would be possible to maybe say that the mind belongs more to the sphere of the archive and matter belongs more to the sphere of the repertoire and embodiment. So in a way, I always end up not finding the mind and matter discussion particularly helpful, because it moves away from the actual phenomena for me and tries to apply a level of theoretical abstraction to it, with which you probably stop being truthful to what really happens. Even though, of course, yes, we notice that in an era and within also a culture or subculture where information and the ability to process information, I mean, it is I think it's inevitable then to make a link, draw a link between the pureness of information and the pureness of the mind, for instance. But in the end, I don't think that the world can be simulated. I don't think that the world can be translated or described solely in terms of information. These are just, I mean, and if we look at the history of media technology, then of course we notice that on the one hand, the recording devices have become better and better, and from the invention of script up to the access to writing, the printing press, etc., we noticed that in the beginning it was recording was a privileged practice that was applied to privileged epistemological objects and privileged individuals who got their likeness painted. And then we noticed that mass media means greater access to different types of recordings. The Kodak camera, everyone can take pictures and have their picture taken. And then also not only is it a democratization of recording tools, but also we notice that more details of everyday life are recorded, for instance, by the means of social media, where I, for instance, and I just talked to this talked about this to Lorenz, who was still there, which put me recently in the interesting position that I had to tell various people to not Twitter that I'm pregnant, because I don't want them to announce this fact to people who are not with me in the same room, for instance. So the facts of life, now here with a slightly different meaning, of course, can now be captured in an ever more finely grained manner than before. Coming back to the issue of relevance, it's probably not all of this is relevant, and I don't know. There were two instances in my life when once a computer died on me and another, an important hard drive died on me, and I think that was one of the most liberating experiences, actually. So rather, so even though we can say that media technology, if there's a certain aim, then the aim is probably well described by what you just presented in your talk: preservation of self, preservation of environments, the ability to slide back and forth in history, probably also developing new models of history. But in the end, I remain unimpressed by this, because I still don't think that we have managed to blame the fact that I've practiced yoga for a while and up to a point where I thought, yeah, mind and matter probably is the same. So